Welcome to Two Men in the Middle. This is where two middle-aged guys from the middle of the country talk about politics and other stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
First off, Brandon, let me apologize because they just called you middle-aged, and that's probably not accurate at this point.
Yeah, I still have a little bit of time left, so I'd like to back off of that
I'm lumping us together. So we didn't do a pod last week because I was on vacation.
Right.
And we get together this week to do this, and once again, you brought up a good point. Last week was such a whirlwind. Do we even try to go back and address anything from last week? Or do we pick something from the 300 topics that we could choose from the first 4 days of this week?
Right. I mean, I can't even recall exactly what happened last week. It almost seems like an eternity ago compared to today. So I think maybe we do highlights.
So I think from last week, the thing that got me a little bit is we need to talk a little bit about immigration. And immigration has probably taken up 30% of our total podcasting time. It's the topic that we just can't seem to get past. And what struck me last week is how ugly that got and how quickly all of that turned ugly, not only for Trump, but for the entire country, and how quickly the media picked up on that. The rhetoric got ratcheted up to 11 almost immediately. And at the end, Trump caved on something. And that's generally not his MO at all. But he did kind of, you know, it was completely false that he could not, he was powerless against it, that this was something that was Congress's job. That kind of all washed away when the photos and the audio tapes and all of that started going out. So I thought it was interesting that that's one thing that the optics got so bad on, even Trump was willing to say, guys, we can't continue with this.
Right. And I think that with Trump, it became a political burden. I think you had members of the House, Republican members, who came to him and said, look, this is impacting poll numbers. This is going to put us in a very precarious position come re-election this fall.
Yeah.
If you don't reverse course, you're going to lose majorities and you won't be able to have this policy. So, you know, I think he was forced into a corner, and it's somewhere he doesn't like to be. And you look now at the repercussions and the fact that there was no procedure or system in place for what they were going to do after this. I literally think the administration thought that this was going to be a deterrent to illegal immigration, and that, hey, if we separate children from their families, you know, they're not going to come, which completely ignores the fact that many of these people are risking, you know, death at home, violent gang members. I mean, to travel, you know, hundreds of miles.
Allegedly, they just shut off the asylum seeking. Allegedly, and I don't know if this is true or not, because that would be illegal, that if somebody came here seeking asylum, they basically told them that was not an option and turned them away at a border crossing or an immigration center.
Right. Well, and I think that's the big piece of this, because it wasn't thought out at all. And no. And I mean, they had no plans for, you know, after where they were going to, how they were going to reunite the children with the families after, you know, the hearings and after the process had taken place. You know, and there would have been, I think, a little bit more understanding if there was any reforms to the process, like we're going to, you know, hasten these hearings and we're going to cut the number of days that these people are held in detention. But that wasn't a part of this process. And now we're left with no system, no real way to reunite these families. And we have children spread out in states across the country now, which is illogical.
So what do you think of Trump's idea of just getting rid of due process and just immediately send these people back?
Well, I mean, he has no idea what he's talking about.
I don't think he does.
This is a, you know, guy who will, you know, say, you know, for the Constitution, and really doesn't understand the articles of the Constitution at all. I mean, there's been plenty of precedent that establishes that there are due process rights even for non-citizens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can't do that. But again, this is, you know, par for the course. If you remember back during the gun debate at one point, you know, he came out on the other side that, absolutely, you know, remove their due process rights. Just go in and take their
just
guns,
take them,
you know, and then backpedaled on that. So
I did see a stat that I think I think I read this correctly, like 82% of all federal courts are immigration. of the hundreds of thousands of cases that federal courts see every year, the vast majority of these are immigration. And the first round of what all these people got separated from their families from, and the court procedure they're waiting on, is they take a group of them, 12 to 20 at a time, in front of a judge. It says, do you plead guilty? All of them say yes. They fine them $10 and they tell them to go back to Mexico. And if they catch you again, that's a felony and you're going to go to jail. So I guess from one point, you can understand looking at that and saying, is it worth all of the resources to do that? But when you balance that out against, do we want to start giving up fundamental rights in the United States? And if we give them up to the least vulnerable first, like immigrants, what's next?
Yeah, where does that stop?
Where does that stop?
It continues. And, you know, both the Bush administration and Obama administration had the policy basically of catch and release for, you know, nonviolent,
absolutely,
you know, just trespassing. They would be released and go through the process hearings. Trump administration, instead of prioritizing violent criminal activity, has basically said that we're going to treat them all the same, and we're going to detain everybody, and there's not going to be any distinction made. The problem is, if you don't increase the resources to handle that, which they have not, what are you going to do? I mean, even within weeks after this policy was implemented, they were scrambling to get judges place to actually adjudicate. And in some cases, they were basically borrowing from firms that were, you know, didn't even have attorneys that specialized in immigration.
Absolutely.
So it's been a nightmare.
And I think that, you know, part of something I want to unpack is that, yes, Bush and Obama in some ways encountered the exact same problem that Trump did, of separating families. Obama's first crack at this was, if we detain you, the children can go with their mother. And that was taken to court, and that was ruled, you can't do that. You can't send children to an adult detention facility. So then they tried to separate. They did separate them. There, the pictures of children separated under Obama. Obama had the same issue. They struggled with the same problem, but their reaction was, we have to catch and release. Where Trump, basically, his reaction was, we have to have zero tolerance. So is it true that Obama had the same effect under him? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. The difference is, one, the scale that it was on, and the fact that Trump specifically used this as a deterrent and as a political piece to try to muscle through an immigration package. That's what makes these two situations completely different, one from the other.
Oh, exactly. The scale and the use of it as a deterrent, and the fact that, you know, there was political calculation behind this.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. He's running on the immigration issue. He thought this would be helpful in the fall, and he would be able to tout some type of success since the border wall is still, you know, not built.
Yeah.
And he really can't, other than, you know, hammer in Congress for that. He has nothing that he can tout to his base, and this was some red meat that he would be able to point to.
And the executive order that he signed, I don't think that holds very long. We talked about before we started, the Ninth Circuit has already said you cannot keep children in an adult facility. So Trump at some point in time will have to pivot back to the catch and release that everybody who tries to solve this problem, this is just one of the pitfalls you fall into. And eventually the only humane thing to do is go back to this kind of cycle of, you cross the border, we just let you go.
Right. I mean, again, this has been adjudicated before, you know, all the other options have been exhausted. I mean, you go back the last two presidential administrations, there's no other option.
So you're a Republican. We've established that.
Right.
I'm a Democrat. We've established that. So when Trump's latest branding effort in the last 2 weeks have been that Democrats all want open borders and we're totally soft on crime and we're fine with MS-13 and gangs. How accurate, I think, do you think that is? And how well is that going to play, you think, to his specific Republican base?
Well, I mean, I think it'll play well to his base, because I think, I mean, his base voted for him because of that rhetoric, particularly on immigration and particularly on, you know, the fear of, you know, he presents it as hordes of, you know, violent criminals coming over the border.
He uses the words infestation and invasion.
Right.
I mean, that to me is so distasteful, but I'm kind of numb to it too. I mean, what else would you expect him to say?
Right. I mean, it will be effective to with his base to a degree. I mean, it's a vast oversimplification. I think if you talk about swing voters, if you talk about unaffiliated, I don't see how that's going to be impactful. Because people, I think, particularly with what has happened with the separation issue, I think it's had a positive effect in terms of waking people up to the complexities and how there's no easy answer.
There's not.
So you can't just say that one side is for open borders and one isn't. You know, there. And I've told my friends this. There's very few people that are actually on that fringe on the left who support complete open borders.
Very, very few.
Right. I mean, they exist, but they're absolute tiny, tiny minority. And the vast majority of people are somewhere between trying to figure out how do we, you know, acknowledge the rule of law, have some type of process, but also treat people humanely. And you, because you can't completely shut it down. What is viable?
And is it, I think you and I would agree that this needs to be solved through the Congress. Keep continuing to do this through executive order is not the way this should be solved. And I was with you. I didn't like when Obama did DACA. I thought it was a complete overreach. But also too, what choice did he have? And to me, the House and the Senate, I don't know what it is that they do anymore, what they add to the process. I mean, the House just again yesterday tried to come up with a package that they could at least get through the House on immigration, some sort of compromise bill that totally failed. So that was, I think, the fourth time in the last 2 weeks they've made an attempt at something. If you go back, I think in March is when the House had like five, or the Senate had like five different bills that they were trying to pass. None of them came even close to getting through.
Oh, no. And there's a divide in the Republican caucus.
Absolutely.
You have the Republican moderates that are pushing a bill that includes border security, but is a little bit less stringent. And you have the hardliners, you know, pushing their own bill, which, you know, doesn't include any type of provisions relating to DACA. And so there's no compromise there. I mean,
so
you can't.
DACA is an 85% issue that Americans agree on, that we should allow those people a path to citizenship and stay in the country.
Right.
So even something that there's overwhelming support on, we can't really take a legislative action on that. It just feels like the legislation is very comfortable just turning over these responsibilities to the president through executive order. And then I bitch about it if I don't like it. I run against it if I'm in a campaign. But actually doing the work to write legislation, I just don't get a sense that that's where we're at this point.
No, if they were willing to pass a standalone fix for DACA tomorrow, it would pass.
I think that would pass.
But they are not willing to pass it alone without, you know, having it attached to all this other legislation, and that's where it fails. But part of the problem is, and I think it's a cynical view, but I truly think that there are many who
you
could
be cynical. Mike was the one who accused me and didn't like it. I was cynical. Let's get cynical.
I think there are members of both parties who are fine with the status quo and not seeing this issue go away because it's a fundraising issue. It's an issue
Absolutely.
That they rally their bases behind. And as long as it's a problem to be solved that will never be solved, they will continue being reelected. So if you take it as an issue off the table, it takes a lot off the table. And for Trump, I mean, it takes, you know, the core of his campaign off
Absolutely.
The table. And what does he run for reelection on then at that point? I mean, he'll run on the economy, obviously, but the scare tactics is what put him over the edge. I mean,
Absolutely.
Forfeit that as an issue.
And you're right. You take immigration away from Trump, what meat is on that bone? I mean, I think the Republicans are already finding out that the tax cut is not going to play the way they think it's going to play. You saw that with Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, where they trotted out a lot of campaign ads and a lot of campaign messaging around that tax cut. I think as most people are getting that tax cut now, they kind of realize this was completely slanted towards corporate America. And we can argue if that was right or that was wrong, but I think people are realizing we added $1 trillion in debt basically to give a tax cut to corporations. And we can debate, too, how much of that is actually the American public going to see either through directly into their paycheck through the tax cut or from a rising wage or a bonus from their employer.
True. And when the increase of the debt is unsustainable over time. And there's that, you know, hypocrisy there, too, with on my side, on the Republican side. But there is you have to acknowledge that, you know, there are a record number of open jobs available right now. Unemployment's at the lowest rate that we have seen in over a decade. So, you know, those indicators are very appealing. But you have to couple that, too, with what's happening with trade now and on the tariff side. So
absolutely.
That, you know, the positive economic news coming from the tax cuts could be completely offset by what's happening with tariffs. You saw the news with Harley-Davidson this week. I mean, that's a huge impact and locally a major impact. And
so let's talk about that a minute, because part of the thing with Harley is I know Obama went after Staples and some other companies when they basically said we're cutting more people back down to part time because we don't want folks to we don't want to have to pay Obamacare. And Obama commented directly, not to the amount of vile that Trump has come out after Harley, where he's almost personally threatened them and kind of what this action is. One, as a Republican, that's got to make you extremely queasy of like, what in the world is that? Especially to an iconic brand like Harley Davidson. The second thing, too, is in some ways, Harley got tens of millions of dollars in tax breaks to come to the Kansas City area and to build a plant here. That gave us no guarantee, though, that they would keep the plant here.
Right.
So I think part of this is when, as a community, when we say, hey, listen, we will, you're, for creating the jobs that you created, we're going to lower or eliminate your tax burden, and we're fine with that. It always seems like that we get holding the bag on something like that. Shouldn't there be, if you get a big tax cut as a business or you get tens of millions of dollars of tax breaks to build a plant, hey, on your way out the door, you know, hey, maybe we need to settle up in some way with that.
Yeah, well, I think so. And I think you have to be careful. You know, I'm somebody who supports the judicious use of incentives to attract viable
Absolutely.
Economic development. I think they definitely have a place. If you look at TIF, if you look at CID, if you look at tax abatements, they all have a role to play. And I think you have seen some cities start to do that. They implement in localities clawbacks, you know, requirements that a business has to stay within, you know, that locality for a certain number of years, which I think is fine. I mean, I think, you know, if you start to attach too many requirements to them, you're not going to see any business bite on them. And so they're not going to be effective at
and
that
nice
point.
And nice to see
so
liberal Seattle folded like a cheap tent to Amazon on their headcount tax.
Oh, yes.
They were going to do like the $225 per year tax on headcounts to businesses over $4 million.
But, you know, I thought that was like the most ridiculous tax. I thought it was an example of liberalism completely out of control. I mean, you do not tax productivity and, you know, growing economy. And that's basically what it was. Yeah. It's like, if you're growing, you know, we're going to basically punish you for that. I mean, what incentive is there to grow? Why would it Amazon or Boeing decide to say, okay, we're going to move our headquarters in?
And as a DIM, I agree with that. That was a ridiculous idea. You can't tax your way out of your homelessness problem. And what I would think is, if the mayor or somebody in Seattle went to Amazon, Starbucks, some of those big companies and say, you're going to give us $250 million.
Right.
And
we'd like to partner with you.
Absolutely.
We have this problem. How can
and
we come together and solve it?
$1 billion worth of I would imagine they would say
PR,
absolutely,
great
we
PR.
Can do that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that they wouldn't step up in some way to help with that. So I agree with you. Let's talk about, as a Democrat and of this, the election of Trump, one of our worst fears happened this week where Justice Kennedy retires or is going to retire at the end of July. And suddenly now there's this realization Trump is going to get to reshape the Supreme Court. For generations to come. We were joking about this a little bit, but, you know, he did the same thing and he did the expected thing with Gorsuch. Does he go completely off the reservation now and it's Judge Perino, the Fox lady, or, you know, I said, this is Scott Baio going to be the next Supreme? I mean, Ted Cruz. Does he feel like, hey, I've done the expected thing. I've got the wind at my back at this now to really kind of fire the base up. Now I'm going to go out and do something next that could be ridiculous.
I still think he has to be careful. Obviously, Republicans have the numbers in the Senate, but they don't have numbers to spare. And yes. So if you look at just senators that are retiring, like Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, Lisa Murkowski, and, you know, Collins in Maine.
Yeah.
I mean, Susan Collins. So, you know, all four of those are typically swing votes when it's on the Senate side. And you've had, I believe, Susan Collins has already come out and said, you know, she's very wary of it, you know, that Roe v. Wade is settled law. She doesn't want to see a justice confirmed who's going to upset that
so
apple cart.
Let's talk about that for 1 second. So I have a sneaky suspicion that let's say we have the Republican leadership in this room. We have McConnell, Trump, and Ryan. And there's a big red button on the wall. And it's, guys, to reverse Roe v. Wade, all you have to do is go press that. Just press it. And it's overturned. Now, the press corps is right outside, so you got to go explain what you just did. I don't think the Republicans, they would slit each other's throat to keep somebody from pressing that button. Because the Republicans know if under their watch, Roe v. Wade is reversed, have fun electing governors in Mississippi, because that's what your party's going to be.
Yeah, and I think there's an acknowledgement of that. And so, yeah, I think what we're going to see is nominees who are in the mold more of Gorsuch. I would be surprised not to see that. So you're going to see somebody who's definitely more conservative than Anthony Kennedy, who's like the quintessential center-right, centrist.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you look at the decisions, I mean, he was, you know, pivotal behind the gay marriage decision. If you look at affirmative action, death penalty cases, you know, and so he was, you know, lauded by the right and jeered by them at times and same by the left, which truly shows you the, you know, the makeup of his opinions.
Yeah.
So you're not going to have another Anthony Kennedy, but the age of swing justices like Kennedy and like Sandra Day O'Connor,
they're done.
Mean, you're just not going to have that because it's become so politicized.
Yeah.
And, you know, both sides see it as a way to shape their agenda. And that was, you know,
It wasn't always the case.
It was not always the case. And you saw a little bit kind of bubble up to the surface, you know, starting in the 80s, but you still had moderate justices who were able to get through with no votes against them, which is unheard of. That would not happen today.
That's not going to happen. There's a part of me as a Democrat that says with the shit McConnell pulled with Merrick Garland, I want every Democratic senator, nothing. Help me out. Is it still 60 votes? I know there's...
So the Republicans changed the rules, so you only need 51 votes now.
Did the
so
Democrats...
the filibuster rule. Only for Supreme Court justices.
Right. So the Democrats, a couple years ago, they changed it for lower level, and then kind of in retaliation, the Republicans changed it for the Supreme Court.
Right.
So you only have to get 51. Okay.
You only have to get 51 for the Supreme Court. And again, you know, that could come back to bite Republicans at some time down
Absolutely.
The road when Democrats hold everything and then they can't filibuster. So both sides play that game.
When Trump and people talk about the Senate needs to be 51, what that tells me is you don't understand what the Senate is. The Senate is
designed deliberative body.
To gain consensus. They have 6-year terms. They're supposed to be looking beyond the horizon.
And the Senate is supposed to move slow. People say that they're frustrated with the pace, the Senate is a slow-making deliberative body. The House is the body that is the opposite of that. And they, you know, balance each other out that way. And it prevents, you know, really, you know, bad legislation from moving forward.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
And it's really, really hard to get 60 senators. And when you have it for a very short time.
Right.
Nobody holds a supermajority in the Senate for long. But there's part of me that...
Well, and senators are supposed to be less or more immune, I should say, to political pressures because they serve 6-year terms. They're not up for election every 2 years.
It's so like 92% of them get reelected.
Right.
So once you're there, a lot of them can stay as long as they want. Some of me wants the Democrats to burn the House down and say, McConnell, you started this. We're going to finish it. Where do you stand on what McConnell pulled with Merrick Garland?
Well, I mean, I was not a fan of that. I think it set a very bad precedent. And I think that, you know, McConnell, unfortunately, looks hypocritical now.
Absolutely.
And so he's trying to play this as, oh, things were different back then. It was a presidential year and it was the end of a presidential term. But the point is, you set a precedent for that. This is a tactic that can be used, and so you have put it on the table, and so you can't complain if the other side is going to use that now. And so, I think it's put us in a very bad spot. So no, I was not a fan of the way that was used. I don't think that helps at all in the long term.
I don't think so either.
And I think it just it makes this process much more toxic than it ever has been.
And we've talked, elections have consequences for people who sat this out because they didn't like Hillary or they didn't like Trump or they were disappointed that Bernie didn't get the nomination or they think the Democrats screwed Bernie. Whatever it is, you know, this is whatever Supreme Court judge gets picked and however the court gets reshaped, you could look at it as that's a consequence of that decision.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were many people who, you know, ended up voting for Trump who, you know, didn't like him and they voted for him just for the Supreme Court.
Just for this.
Yeah. Nope. Again, because, you know, wanting to reshape the court for, you know, decades to come.
See, as a lib, the Supreme Court, in my opinion, has been a disaster the last 20 years. I mean, in thank you, Heller versus D.C., where basically Scalia decided any human being in the United States can own any type and any gun and as many as you want, when they completely ignored the first half of the Second Amendment, the militia, and just went to the second half and basically set the tone for absolutely no meaningful gun control. This is the same body that bought you Citizens United. I mean, the Supreme Court, people saying that, well, it's leaned left for the past 20, 30 years. It's time for a level set. As somebody that leans left myself, it'd be like, really? I mean, there's been some decisions that have come out of the Supreme Court that I would not describe as liberal or progressive and squarely kind of in the conservative arena.
I agree. I don't think it's leaned left. Some of the decisions have been pretty far right. Others have been more in the middle. There's been a few that have been left of center. I think it would be hard to categorize it. I mean, if you go back over the last 30 years exactly, you know, say it's left of center, right of center.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely not left. It's probably somewhere center right. If you look at all the decisions,
I think
that's
fairly
the board.
Accurate. But they've let out some really big decisions in the last 10, 15 years that have really shaped a lot of policy, really, and is going to continue to shape it. What was your interpretation of their upholding of the travel ban or the Muslim ban, as most people refer to it? Do you think that was something that, do you agree that the president, under the authority of protecting the nation, can basically pick five Muslim countries and say, you're out, you can't do it?
Yeah, I think that's difficult. I do think that there is authority in the executive branch when it comes to, you know, regulating entry into the country. You know, and you have to remember too that the president backpedaled the first two versions of this travel ban.
This is travel ban
3.0
finally got
through. And
that's
what the court was ruling on. So you have to kind of detach that from the prior bans, because I don't think the prior bans would have been upheld. And so it was a very narrow ruling on this instance of the travel ban. You know, and again, you can be cynical and say, you know, because they would point and say, well, you know, Venezuela was in there. There were some non-Muslim countries that they
North
threw
Korea.
Those in. Right. So, but at the end of the day, I think it was very narrowly tailored. And so I don't think, again, if there's additional cases that come before the court related, you know, I don't think it necessarily means that, you know, it would be upheld in other ways. It was a very narrow instance of it being upheld based on, you know, the 3.0 version. So I think you have to realize that.
I understand the presidential powers to keep the country safe, but I also understand that Trump basically has Canada on the watch list, for his justification for tariffs. So I know too that the president we have right now uses
Canada
national security
threat.
Absolutely. He deemed them as a national security threat. So how can you take that and kind of apply that he has a normalized logic or a normalized rationalization for putting this ban on those five specific countries? That's what's so hard to kind of work out in the wash with Trump. There are times when he does stuff and says, okay, in this particular instance, I kind of agree with you. And there's a path, I think, that you can take. But then you use the same principle over here, and you're absolutely and totally wrong.
I'll agree. But you have to realize the court's job is to detach the personality from the policy. They need to look at the policy, the way it's implemented, the way that it's being carried out, and whether or not that's constitutional.
So the lower courts took into account his tweets and his personal behavior. The Supreme Court did not. If I'm Trump, that is very emboldening. That's basically saying, once again, now the Supreme Court has told me there are absolutely zero consequences
for
my rhetoric and what I say.
But that's a universal problem with Trump, because he doesn't see any limits on his power and authority. I mean, he constantly has to be backed down from positions that are not even within the scope of his authority as the executive.
So I hate using Nazi references. Mike and I had an argument about this one time. It's like, you got to stop saying Nazi. Nazi is a very specific term that covers a very specific period of time. And nobody in the United States in the government should ever be compared to a Nazi. It's just not a viable term. It's something that if you're calling somebody a Nazi, you need to read a book.
You need to understand what actually happened.
With that said, you know, Maxine Waters... I'm not a fan of Maxine Waters. I understand that her district in California is extremely liberal. You know, she can get away with that at the local ground level. But what she did this week with, I kind of read and parsed out some of her words. I don't think she exactly said or advocated violence against the administration, but she came close enough. She came close enough that somebody could possibly interpret that way, and that's too far.
Right, and the problem is it's irresponsible. I mean, she is in a position of elected authority, has a, her own bully pulpit, so to speak. And so you have to be more responsible with your words. And again, across the board, everybody needs to be responsible, politicians on both sides. So, and we've seen the extreme of this with Trump and several people of his administration. But that doesn't mean that you counter that by, again, getting very close to that edge. And again, all it takes is one unhinged, unstable person to read into that something that isn't intended and to go out and do something.
From a sheer political side, no Democrat's going to pull off Trump. You're not going to out-Trump him. You're not going to out-vulgar him. You're not going to out-childish him. You got to let him go. If you try to do that, it's not going to play the same way because you don't have the same base. And for some reason, and we'll have to sit down years after Trump's gone and figure out what happened, he gets a complete pass in those areas. We just don't pin that to him. I don't think we've truly unpacked why that is. But at this point, you're not going to make any hay trying to be more vulgar or more gross or disgusting, unfortunately, than the president of the United States.
No, and I mean confronting those that support him and those that work for him, in a very public way like that. Yeah. What does that accomplish? I mean, it could lead to violence. It leads to probably entertaining television. Yeah. But beyond that, it does nothing to further discourse in the country, and it does nothing to further goals at the ballot box. A more effective message would have been to say, we need to mobilize. We need to register people to vote. We need to, have a mass effort aimed at changing direction of this country.
Agree.
That's what's going to change policy.
I also feel that woman's pain at the Red House Inn or the Red Hen Inn or whatever that was to basically say, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you get in front of the country and you lie every single day. And you do it with a smirk on your face and you do it with a disdain, I think, for the American people and the American press. So I understand in that moment saying, you know what? Not going to do it. I don't think it's right.
Right.
I think you're playing right into their hands. But I understand that woman's feeling and the staff's feeling. If she walked in, I could see having that moment of, wait a minute, nobody holds this person accountable. Nobody on the Republican side is talking about what she's doing. And there's a lot of people that feel she is genuinely damaging the country. So I get it that in that moment, you think this is a good idea without playing out the long game a little bit and saying, this is us falling right into what the Republican trap is.
Well, it is. And the other problem is I think it's a tipping point. I mean, throughout the years, there's been plenty of instances where you've seen people that have protested administration officials in public and registered their complaints, which is fine. I think that's really ramped up now for obvious reasons under the current administration. But I can't recall any time we've seen an administration official actually, kicked out of a restaurant. I just, you know, and passions are inflamed. I totally get that, but it does, it's a slippery slope. And I think it, we're at a point where
I agree,
you know, that could continue. And I don't think that's a good place for us as society to see people who are thrown out of public establishments just based on, you know, again, you know, political differences, major, major political differences, but all the same.
Is there a difference between political difference and somebody looking at somebody like Sarah Huckabee Sanders and basically saying, if nobody's going to hold you accountable, I am? Because this has been one of the frustration parts for the dim side. I think the media should just stop coming to all of her review, all of her her press conferences, and just render her useless. Because all she does is basically stand up there and just spout untruth after untruth after untruth. Again, I agree with you. If we keep going like this, somebody's going to get hurt.
Well, something I think bad that would be effective. If the media did a mass boycott and you see that empty room, absolutely, that sends a much louder message.
Walk out.
You have to recognize Sarah Huckabee Sanders is basically a vessel of the administration. Her job is to parlay whatever they want her to. So her job, again, this is a cynical viewpoint, is not necessarily to tell the truth, so to speak. It's to relay the administration's viewpoint on whatever the issue is of the day. I think the problem we've had is we have seen it taken to a whole new level in terms of just not being transparent, just not answering direct questions at all in many cases.
Yeah.
So it's, again, understand that, but it's a very bad situation to be in.
Well, and now if you're a Democrat, Trump has branded the whole Democratic Party the party of Nancy Pelosi and Maxine Waters.
Oh, yeah.
And when is Democrats, when are we going to learn that the coasts are locked up? Don't worry about that.
And that footage, by the way, will be played, absolutely, you know, repetitively throughout the campaign.
Ohio, Pennsylvania, season. Florida, that's Wisconsin. That's where this is going to be won or lost. And most Democrats in those area, they care most about dinner table topics, economic opportunities, job opportunities, all of this stuff kind of that the left sometimes gets itself wrapped into just doesn't play well and just isn't top of mind for those folks. I think that's where we lost them to Trump in 2016. And when Maxine Waters does that, and that's just setting itself back up for potentially that to go wrong again.
Well, it's an unnecessary diversion.
Absolutely. You know,
it's completely unhelpful.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. If anybody's listening to this who has any power in the Democratic Party, dump Pelosi. Everybody running for Congress has to come out and say, my first act is I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House.
So speaking of that,
Brandon just picked up a notepad. Here we go.
So the new nominee in a New York City-based House district.
Oh, that's our third topic, yeah.
Yeah, who actually won. One of her talking points was that she was not going to be a vote for Pelosi as
absolutely
Speaker. So she ran on that. And so, you know, this past Tuesday, primaries took place across the country, various states. And it was interesting because I think for the most part, we've been talking about primaries on the Republican side.
Yeah.
You know, the Trump loyalists versus, you know, those that dare to be slightly independent or criticize the president. But there's a lot to be said for what's happening in the Democratic Party and this battle between establishment Democrats and more progressive Democrats. Yeah. And we saw that play out with the defeat of Joe Crowley, which nobody saw losing.
Nope. I mean, people were saying that he could be a serious contender for Speaker against Pelosi.
Exactly. I mean, he's held that district for decades. He was the Democratic caucus chair in the House. He's the chair of the local Democratic Party there, I think either in Queens or the Bronx. I mean, he had everybody behind him. And the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, it's like three. Yeah.
Who defeated
him. I'm glad you said that because I could never have gotten that out.
So she was a bartender just back in November.
She's 28
years old.
She? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this progressive candidate rallied, you know, people behind her, and she just had, again, completely outspent, but, you know, did the door to door and just, you
absolutely
know, very grassroots.
Boots on the
and
ground.
Won. Now, what's interesting about her, she is a very self-declared Democratic socialist.
Yeah.
has said, criticized Crowley for voting to create the Department of Homeland Security. She wants to abolish ICE. She believes universal Medicare, federal jobs guarantee.
I'm going to let you read this list, but as a Republican, you're just like, bring more of these folks on, right?
So she is not mainstream. She's not somebody that would win in the heartland.
Absolutely.
She would not be somebody who would win outside of the coast, basically. Yeah. Which is fine because this is a very left district that's never going to fall in Republican hands.
That one is safe.
But the I think caveat here is that if candidates such as her get nominated in swing districts, it doesn't portend well. So there needs to be a clear understanding of nominating candidates that fit their districts.
Yeah.
Look at the Pennsylvania House district this last time around. Perfect candidate fit his district.
Absolutely.
And you have to have that. So, your party would do well to recognize that and not get caught up in nominating only a slew of Bernie supporting progressives in districts across the country, because that does them no favors.
I think there's more women running for congressional seats than ever before. I saw a stat where I think it's at like 110 in 110 districts. There's a woman running in the primary or on the ballot, which is at an all time high. And like 94% of them are running as Democrats.
Right.
What our hope is that the sheer number of women running is an indication of the excitement for women candidates and is a precursor to women female turnout. I've said this before. I get yelled at every time. I'm going to keep saying it. The third rail that got Trump elected was 54% of white college educated women voted for him. That's what didn't see coming. Ladies, if you've had enough, this is your shot. If you want to end this right now, all you have to do is pull a straight Democratic ticket. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I do think there's some mounting evidence that coalition of educated white suburban voters can't hold for Trump.
No, I don't see it happening.
It may hold through the midterms because midterms are weird. A lot of people don't vote. If there's not an issue or a candidate, that's what we're going to find out. Are those people so energized by the first 2 years of Trump and the number of female candidates running that they come out in mass? And that's what brings the blue wave in.
Well, and there's something to be said. I mean, Congress still has a very low number of women among its
ranks. Absolutely.
I mean, we in the United States still rank at the bottom in the Western world for parity when it comes to elected bodies. So there's a lot of ground, I think, to still make up there. And there's clearly still an energy and enthusiasm gap. You know, the Democrats have the energy, they have the enthusiasm.
Yep.
The question now with the Supreme Court vacancy is to see which side becomes more energized.
I'm hoping it's the female Democrat who see things like Roe v. Wade, LGBTQ rights, things that are core issues to female Democrat voters. They realize if we don't do something, we could lose some. We could take a huge step back. If you saw Trump as a step back as a liberal or as a progressive, but thinking it's only Trump, these type of core pillar issues are safe. Not anymore. All of it's in play with this pick. And to your point, even if he gets blown out in 2020. He's still probably going to get another Supreme Court justice. If he stays for another term, he's going to get at least one. He's going to get probably two.
Right.
I mean, so for people too, if you don't think this is serious or you think issues that care about you are so far baked into the culture that they can't be touched, think again.
Well, and if you're a voter, all you have to do is look at the number of 5-4 decisions we've had in the past 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, and all of these 5-4 decisions were significant.
All the big ones, guys, come down
major
to 5-4.
Major impact decisions. Yeah.
And Kennedy, a lot of times, was the deciding factor.
He was.
You replace him with Judge Judy or Matlock or whoever the hell Trump digs up, Ivanka. I want to make sure people understand this has the ability to shape things for you, boots on the ground as an American for the next 30 years. And it's depending on how this goes, you're either going to love this or you're really, really, really going to not be happy.
Well, and the key takeaway, too, is we're not going to have justices like Kennedy again anytime soon.
No.
I mean, Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor before him, the quintessential swing justices, center-right, I mean, who was, you know, would make people on either side either upset or happy with him, depending on the votes. But he was somebody that put a lot of deliberation and thought into his decisions. And, you know, he's spoken on this more candidly over the last 5 to 10 years than he has before. But for him, you know, he said that most of his decisions were, you know, based on individual liberty. So being able to protect that. And then also, you know, individual respect and respecting the individual and making sure that they had. And so that transferred over, if you look at his decisions, not only on gay marriage, but also other gay rights cases like Lawrence v. Texas. So it kind of all came down to that for him. But it's, you're not going to have that swing vote anymore. So a lot of these decisions will be going into the future will be more predictable than they have been in the past. And so I think that's what's going to rev everybody up, because we saw a little bit of that with O'Connor, you know, when she retired, but there was still that one swing vote, and now that one swing vote is not going to be there.
Well, you talk about when Supreme Court justices, where it all went downhill in the nominating process. A lot of this is when Ted Kennedy got up on the Senate floor and gave one of the most over-the-top partisan speeches. I think it was against Bork.
It was against Bork. And I mean, just completely ripped him apart.
You've
completely
got
unprecedented.
To be kidding. I think a lot of people point to that speech as, say, if you really want to know when people started drawing lines and saying, hey, we're gonna politicize this entire process, that's probably a pretty good,
that was the catalyst.
Good point. That was the catalyst. And then what McConnell pulled with Merrick Garland, that was, if you're too young to remember what Kennedy did, that one really solidified a lot of folks as well.
Yeah, because it said we're going to take this to a whole new level. Not only are we going to, you know, personally destroy the reputation or besmirch a nominee, we are going to completely take them off the table for political purposes and, you know, basically hedge our bets on being able to win. And again, you know, it moved the goalposts and it set a really bad precedent for either side to play those games now. And you have to realize we have elections every 2 years in this country. Yeah. So depending on when a nominee is...
Is that a new rule?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't,
it,
I
this
don't
becomes,
think it should be.
Does it become the norm? I could see that happening.
Jeff Flake was on MSNBC this week, and he said something that... You know, Mitch McConnell has told the Senate, we will not put any legislation on the docket that Trump will not sign. And Flake's like, I just completely disagree with that. The Senate's job is to debate these things, to your point, take the longer view, slow things down, but put your opinion on the record for the American public to see and become part of the debate. Mitch McConnell in a speech to the Senate said, we're in the personnel business. That's really what we do. We're here to push judges, cabinet positions, and the Supreme Court. And the only legislation we're going to get involved with is when Trump signals this is what he wants and he will sign it. What a horrible way to look at the United States Senate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a way of viewing themselves as a rubber stamp rather than viewing themselves as basically a stopgap to and a check, right? I mean, the whole idea is you have three co-equal branches of government, and the Senate stands out among the two legislative bodies in terms of being able to say, whoa, let's slow down, let's really think about this, and being a check if there's an abuser of the president's power, if there's something being shoved through the House that, you know, should have passed muster. That's what they're there for. But, you know, that's been chipped away the last several years.
So give me one politician that you would not get your picture taken with. Since Seth Rogen blew off Paul Ryan and said he would, give me one politician that you'd say, no, I can't do it.
I mean, there's probably several just because I've been disappointed just in general in politics.
Just give me one. The first one that pops to mind, I would never want that to happen.
So I guess Rudy Giuliani is one.
That's a good one.
Who I used to be a big fan of. I thought he led very well in the aftermath of 9/11. I actually supported him as a Republican presidential nominee back in 2008. And so I've, you know, completely at the point where I would never
You supported Rudy Giuliani in 2008?
I did, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I thought he was a great candidate. I thought he ran a great campaign.
Is he just insane? Is he? Does he know this is his last moment in the sun? And he's so desperate to hold on to it, he'll do anything, even making himself a complete joke to do so.
I think so. I mean, it's not the Giuliani that I think that I remember. And many pundits have said that on TV, that something seems to be unglued in there. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot now. And I guess it's been interesting through the Trump years to see how many people have capitulated and just completely, you know, people that I respect and admired. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I can more easily tell you people that I would have my photo taken with, because there's fewer of those now versus people that I would not.
See, mine would be Mitch McConnell. Yeah. My distaste for him, as most Democrats have, I think he is one of the core issues, one of the core problems, I think, with the amount of gridlock that we have and how dysfunctional we are right now is McConnell's leadership in the Senate. He's probably my least favorite politician. I don't know what to make of Trump. How do you rate him? How do you look to him? The rallies that he has.
I
was on vacation with a buddy. We were motorcycle riding, and he's never watched a Trump rally.
Did you have him tune in?
So we turned on the news. And I'm like, oh, you are in for a treat tonight.
There's only so much you can watch.
And he's like 20 minutes. Like an hour, he's like, you've got to change this. He's like, what is this? And he did it this again, I think, in North Dakota. I'll give it to Trump. He is really putting boots on the ground to support Republican candidates. I think I don't know what to say. Is it acceptable now to say you back Trump and it's acceptable to buy into the Trump agenda? It felt like 3 or 4 months ago, nobody would have that guy out there. And now, what is it? Because of the tax break? Is it because of his immigration stance, or what is it that suddenly now he can hit the ground and be a supportive Republican?
You have to keep in mind that he's hitting the ground in primaries.
True.
So again,
which they're tacking way to his side.
Right. And he has an edge in the primaries with the base turnout. So I don't know that you'll see the degree of political stumping and
that's
fall.
True. Once we get to the general,
right? Now, I mean, particularly in the swing states, I don't think they will be caught dead with Trump. I mean, next
I think
to
there's
them.
Certain ones that there's just no way.
Yeah.
He's just going to sink them. Now, we done for this week? Or we got anything else of importance to cover?
I think we hit all the highlights.
So if the pace holds, by the time we get back together next week, once again, there'll be like huge sections of importance that we can't cover because it just moves too fast.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that there are plenty. I mean, we could probably take up hours and hours of time.
How much better would the world be if all news programs were once a week for like 90 minutes and that's it? That might be the way to go.
I think for sanity purposes, right? There's only so much news you could take daily.
There's always
breaking
so much
news.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you, Brandon.